You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's been a year since the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, with climate change measures as part of the package. Check out the latest debates about how to use that environmental funding. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the U.S. women's national soccer team was recently eliminated from the World Cup during a round of 16 match against Sweden. The U.S. lost during a penalty kick shootout after 120 minutes of play left them tied 0-0 with Sweden. It was the team's earliest ever exit from the World Cup. While many fans were disappointed, some conservative commentators celebrated the loss on social media and elsewhere. Here's talk show host Megyn Kelly.
Longtime team leader and activist Megan Rapinoe was smiling and laughing to herself after missing the crucial penalty kick. It was overall just an embarrassing performance for this team from the start. They donned the uniforms of the United States of America, but they refused to honor anything we stand for. And therefore, I'm thrilled they lost. Good. I'm glad you went down. You don't support America, I don't support you. And I know I'm not alone.
Other conservative figures shared the sentiment, including former President Trump, who taunted star forward Megan Rapinoe for missing her penalty kick and said, quote, woke equals failure. This isn't the first time U.S. women's soccer players have faced criticism for their political views and activism. And according to our guest today, it's part of a broader trend of women athletes facing extra scrutiny on and off the field. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you rooting for or against the U.S. women's soccer team? Did it have anything to do with their political and social views expressed by the team as a whole, by individual members? What do you think about athletes, current, former athletes, expressing themselves politically? Do you want to see more of it, less of it? Why? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cheryl Cookie is a professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University. She's the co-author of Serving Equality, Feminism, Media, and Women's Sports, and of No Slam Dunk, Gender, Sport, and the Unevenness of Social Change. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be here.
First of all, Cheryl, can you talk about the kinds of social or political activism that we've seen from the U.S. Women's soccer community over the years that these conservative commentators are criticizing?
Yeah, I think I can't speak to exactly what the conservative commentators are directly focused on, although I have my own thoughts on that. But I think when we look at the women's soccer team, certainly over the last 4 or 5 years, but even going back as far as probably even then the early iterations of the World Cup team back in the 90s, the team itself has been focused on equal pay, inequality in women's soccer, both at the national team level and sort of globally as well, right? And so I think when we look at kind of the activism of these athletes, it really has, I think, most visibly been centered on equal pay and being treated equally, receiving comparable compensation, comparable travel, other kinds of resources that the men's national team receives. And certainly we can have a broader conversation about that. I think the other kind of piece of political activism by some members of the U.S. women's national team has really revolved around social justice, and in particular supporting the Black Lives Matter movement from a few years back. And I think we see that most visibly in the media with Megan Rapinoe as one of the kind of first athletes outside of women's basketball, men's basketball, and football to start joining Colin Kaepernick in his kneeling during the national anthem in response to police brutality and other forms of social injustice faced by Black and brown communities.
Now, the quote I mentioned from former President Trump seemed to equate woke, as the word is used, with failure. Is there any sense that this team is any more politically or socially active than they were 4 years ago when they won the World Cup, 8 years ago when they won the World Cup? Can we say that there's any connection between their political and social activism and their success on the field?
I don't think there's any connection. I think that this is part of a larger conservative strategy to use women's sports as a cultural wedge. And I don't necessarily believe that conservative commentators, those who are kind of posting online, are really invested one way or another in this particular issue outside of just a way to kind of mobilize a base. And certainly the language that's being used very much taps into kind of larger dynamics within kind of conservative political strategies around sort of demonizing any type of efforts or movements that address social inequality, particularly around race, around gender, around sexuality and sexual orientation. And so I think this is women's sports for me as a scholar who's been studying this for the last several decades, is really occupying a unique space within the culture of kind of being the center point for this kind of larger political strategy around again, mobilizing, you know, base voters. And so what's striking to me, though, Rob, in all of this is the kind of ways in which the U.S. women's national team were celebrated in previous World Cups when they won. And certainly, as we mentioned at the top of the segment here, you know, they were very much involved in equal pay, equality, social justice kinds of issues at that time. And they were embraced by, I think, all Americans. I was actually doing some research looking at media coverage on sport news, televised highlight shows. And in fact, ESPN spent quite some time covering the final game of the women's tournament. And the graphics and the commentator itself was very much draped in a kind of, you know, USA patriotism, red, white, and blue graphics that sort of accompanied a lot of stories on different networks. The women were talked about as being, you know, kind of patriotic. And I think this is interesting and part of a larger trend in the research, which is that when women's sports are just kind of in the day-to-day, everyday coverage, we might not see them sort of make it in the headlines, you know, on the highlights and so on. But certainly when women, whether it's the Olympics, whether it's the World Cup, whether it's sort of major Grand Slam tournaments, when women are participating in those major international competitions, the media coverage certainly spikes. And oftentimes it's really driven by a kind of national pride and kind of nationalism or nationalist sort of sentiment. And so this to me seems much, it's more distinct than the kind of previous ways that we've seen women's sports talked about, at least within this particular segment of kind of conservative media spaces.
Talking to Cheryl Cookey from Purdue University, author of No Slam Dunk, Gender, Sport, and the Unevenness of Social Change, talking about the U.S. women's soccer team, their exit from the World Cup, criticism, especially from conservatives over political and social stances taken by the team and by members of that team. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cheryl, going back a long time, men and women's sports, I think sometimes we hear the idea, you know, I go to sports, someone might say to not think about politics and difficult social issues, and people kind of concerned when those issues find their way into sports. This has been going on for decades, of course. What are your thoughts about that idea of keeping politics one way or another out of our sports?
I think that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that sports studies scholars and I've seen other sports journalists talk about this as well is the ways in which politics has been inherently a part of sports, you know, since in some ways the kind of origins of modern sports in the United States. And we see that particularly during Olympic years, right? The kind of idea that athletes, American athletes, are representing the nation. The idea that sort of politics infuses sports, I think, really became very strikingly visible in the sort of post 9/11 moment, right, where we saw a tremendous shift in terms of the sort of influx of a kind of patriotic and celebration of the United States, celebration of the military, right, become infused in the ways in which sports, and in particular men's football, baseball, and basketball, were kind of packaged and sold to consumers, right? So we start to see the national anthem being played consistently during games, people standing for the anthem, the large American flags that are draped across football, entire football fields, the kind of military appreciation nights. All of these things are sort of examples that scholars point to sort of talk about the ways that a particular kind of politics becomes infused in the ways that sports are presented, in the ways that sports are broadcast, in terms of how we're expected to show and demonstrate pride as fans, as players, as spectators. And so I think the idea or the notion that sports is somehow devoid of politics is somewhat countered in that. And I'm thinking specifically around the report that came out, I think it was back in 2014, and this was a report that was published by Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain, who were looking into the ways in which government spending was being used to support these military appreciation events and the ways in which taxpayer money was being funneled into the kind of patriotic displays that were happening in sporting events. And as a fan or as a viewer, you might be sitting at home and thinking like, oh, well, this is great. The NFL is celebrating our military. And in fact, what this was a very kind of concerted strategy, whereby, taxpayer money was going to, support these events and essentially going into the pockets of these leagues. And so I think that when we look to those particular examples, again, particularly in the 9/11, post 9/11 moment, we see politics and a particular kind of politics become very much infused in the sport landscape. The kind of politics that aren't welcome in sport, though, are the kind of politics where athletes are advocating for things like social justice, equality, addressing social issues around, poverty in Black communities. If we go as far back to the 1968 Olympics and the Black Power protests by Tommy Smith and John Carlos, right? So, I hope that's enough evidence, sure, maybe to convince some viewers that really politics is kind of part and parcel of sports. And so when we say, I don't want politics in sports, I think we have to ask the question, well, which kind of politics are we talking about here?
We're talking to Cheryl Cookey, professor at Purdue University, who studies the gender politics of sports, about the recent conservative political backlash against the U.S. women's national soccer team, who faced an early elimination from the World Cup last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you following the team? Did you like when the team and its members took social and political stances? Did you dislike it? Did it not affect you one way or the other as you watched the games, followed them from afar? Do you think athletes should weigh in on politics and social issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the U.S. team's recent elimination from the World Cup and women athletes facing scrutiny for political activism. Our guest is Cheryl Cookey, professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University, author of a couple of books on related topics. You can join at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the U.S. women's national team's loss at the World Cup? What other highlights from the tournament affected you? What do you think about the politics around all of this? Does it matter to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Susan is with us in Rhinelander. Susan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, just listening to the speaker today, and I was saying I had not heard that soundbite from Megyn Kelly, and hearing it, it really explains why I had seen such a backlash on social media against the team. I'm sure she wasn't alone. But that type of vitriol and that anger, I guess I would just ask, where does that stem from? You know, we all have differing opinions. That's the beauty of our country. We all have our First Amendment rights. And to put that kind of vitriol out there in the public space, where does that stem from? I don't get it, and I just think it's so detrimental.
Susan, thanks for the call. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, Susan, thank you for calling in. That's a great question. I asked myself that question as well. Certainly, you know, my colleagues in political science might be better suited to sort of think about and talk about the ways that politics in the United States has become so polarizing. What really sort of strikes me about that soundbite, though, Susan, is, you know, it's, and I wrote it down, you know, they don't honor anything that we stand for. And to me, I step back and say, okay, well, what is the team standing for? The team stands for equal pay, paying men and women the same amount of money for doing the same type of job. Some of the players stand for equality in terms of giving the same human rights to people who are from marginalized communities, whether we're talking about Black and brown American citizens, whether we're talking about LGBTQ individuals, American citizens, whether we're talking about trans communities and trans American citizens. I mean, these are the kinds of issues that the team is advocating around and is engaged in activism around. And so to me, I think, how is that not about what we as Americans stand for? And so I think going back to a point I made earlier in the segment, I'm not sure if this is really about a kind of investment in women's sports by some of these conservative commentators. Again, I think this is part of a larger conservative strategy to mobilize the base and issues around women's sports. I mean, and particularly trans inclusion in sports is a real kind of hotbed issue right now. That has definitely been effective in from a kind of political strategical standpoint, right? In really rallying the base in ways that maybe other social issues are no longer as effective at. So, you know, Susan, I think that's a great question, and you know, I think it's unfortunate that we're in this this moment, and that the fact that, you know, these are athletes who are just trying to play the game that they love, and do what they've been, you know, working hard to do on this sort of elite international platform, and to come back to the United States and to have that kind of reception, I think is really somewhat discouraging. And the thing that I worry about is, like, what messages do young girls and young boys and young, you know, athletes of all kinds of genders, what kind of messages do they take away from that treatment of women athletes?
Thanks for that call, Susan. We'll go to Andrew now in Oconomowoc. Andrew, hi.
Well, hi, yeah. So I have maybe a little bit of a question and a comment. I've been an athlete all my life, and especially over the years, it's more and more important to stay focused on my event. So I don't want to have to worry about if my teammates or I need to kneel or think of anything political. I just want to concentrate on that day's game and performance and do the best job I possibly can. And I got to ask, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, I think sports is a very good distraction for anybody watching them. They can escape the world. And when some of the athletes started making it political, then there was this outcry, whether it's from conservatives or anybody. I think you're wrong when you say this is a conservative issue versus a liberal issue.
Andrew, thanks for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a conservative issue because we were specifically talking about the conservative backlash. I agree with you. As athletes, certainly you want to be focused on the game. And I think a great way of doing that would be for sports leagues and organizations to stop requiring the national anthem to be played before games. I think another really great way to remove politics from sports is for politicians who are running for the highest office in the country to stop commenting on what players are not doing. That would be another example or strategy. I think, though, the idea that, athletes can somehow disconnect themselves and their identities from who they are as athletes is maybe one that athletes from privileged backgrounds or identities might have an easier time doing. So how does an athlete who's queer, openly trans, sort of not think about these kind of larger issues, particularly when they're part of the contemporary cultural landscape?
Thanks for the call. Andrew and Cheryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cheryl Cookie, Professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University. We've been talking about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team's early exit from the World Cup and the wave of conservative criticism it brought on related to players and the team's political and social viewpoints. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this week's edition of Food Friday, find out how to overcome picky eating. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. First, when it comes to our digestive health, it can be hard to know how to take care of our gut. We might know which foods give us stomach problems, but what about promoting healthy digestion? There's a long list of products out there that contain prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics that claim to be good for our health, but not many of us know what those biotics actually are and whether we actually need them. And it's becoming more and more clear that our gut health is tied to our overall physical and even mental well-being. Our next guest has been covering the latest news about our gut microbiomes, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you take care of your gut health? Have you tried various blank biotic products? Do you eat with your digestive system in mind? What questions do you have about some of the latest science out there on the gut microbiome? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anahad O'Connor is a health columnist who writes about food and nutrition for the Washington Post. He's written a series of columns over the last year looking at how prebiotics, probiotics, supplements, and foods affect our well-being. Anahad, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's explore a key concept here, our gut microbiome. It's an ecosystem in our digestive system. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're finding out about it?
Yeah, so the gut microbiome is essentially a community of microbes primarily in our large intestines and in our colon. It's at the end of our digestive tract, and we have trillions of these microbes. They are bacteria, fungi, all sorts of other little microbes that play a really important role in our health. They help us metabolize our food. They help regulate our immune systems. They produce all sorts of compounds, hormones and enzymes and compounds that are absorbed into our bodies and that affect our levels of inflammation and affect our appetites and seem to even play a role in our risk of getting chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and potentially even cancer. And so there's been more and more research over the years looking at this vast community of microbes that we all have. And our gut microbiomes are almost like fingerprints. No two gut microbiomes are exactly alike. Even when you look at identical twins, they find that about a third of the gut microbiome is inherited. But a lot of our gut microbiome is shaped by lifestyle factors, in particular our diet, but also lifestyle behaviors like stress, how much alcohol we consume, exercise, and a lot of other lifestyles. But this gut microbiome plays a really important role in our health. We're still learning more and more about it every single day, but we know that it's critical to good health.
Reading your coverage on this, Anahad, I kind of had this change of mindset where I think I'm eating food, you know, I'm feeding Rob. In fact, I'm feeding the bacteria and other things that live in Rob's digestive system in a lot of ways, and different members of that community like different kinds of foods. What do we know?
Yeah, absolutely. So every time you take a bite of food, you're not just feeding Rob, you're feeding these trillions of microbes that are at the end of your digestive tract. There are actually even certain components of food like fiber that we eat every day, but we don't actually, human beings don't actually have the enzymes to metabolize fiber. It's our gut microbes that see this fiber and that metabolize it and that turn it into things like short chain fatty acids, which are compounds that are absorbed into our body and that are really good for all sorts of, you know, aspects of our health, from our brain health to our gut health to our levels of inflammation. So, you know, there's been research suggesting that when you're eating a lot of what you might call junk foods, that can have a negative effect on your health and that it might actually be mediated by the gut microbiome. And when you're eating a lot of beneficial foods like fiber, we're learning that one of the reasons these foods that we know are healthy, like fruits and vegetables, you know, fiber-rich plants, one of the reasons they're healthy is because these are the foods that our gut microbes typically love. And when we feed them these fiber-rich foods, our gut microbes are happy and they produce compounds that promote good health.
Our gut microbiome in some ways is really complicated, but Anahad, again, reading your work, it seems like the basic recipe to help the good guys out there is really simple, a variety of plant-based foods. Is that really the starting point we should be thinking about?
Yes. So, you know, a lot of people, when they think about their gut microbiome and promoting gut health, one of the things that comes to mind is taking pills like probiotics, probiotic supplements. And, you know, this sort of makes sense when you think about it on the surface, at least. Probiotic supplements contain probiotics, which just for our listeners out there, a probiotic is a live microbe that has beneficial effects on our health. So people think, oh, well, let me just take the pill and that'll help to seed my gut with beneficial bacteria. But what scientists are actually finding is that the best way, it seems, to promote an optimal or beneficial gut microbiome is by focusing on these fiber-rich foods, because by doing that, you know, if you think of your gut microbiome as sort of an ecosystem or even an intestinal garden, you know, you want to give your garden a lot of good fertilizer. It's not enough just to lay down the seeds. You want to actually give those foods, those seeds nutrition. And that's where fertilizer comes in. And the fertilizer for our gut microbiome is these fiber-rich foods. And there's also been studies showing that one of the best ways to promote a, you know, what we think is a healthy gut microbiome is by eating a particular type of foods. And those are fermented foods. Fermented foods like kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir, yogurt, even kombucha, even some fermented cheeses. These things have the probiotics, the live beneficial microbes, but they also have these other components as well. They have the prebiotics, which are the fiber, you know, the fertilizer for the gut microbes, the probiotics, and they also have postbiotics. So postbiotics, not to confuse you, but postbiotics are the compounds that the probiotics produce. You know, these microbes, when, you know, they live in our gut and they're metabolizing our food and they're creating a bunch of byproducts, and those byproducts they produce are called postbiotics. And those are the compounds like short chain fatty acids that we absorb into our body and, you know, help us to have a, you know, thriving, help us to be in good health, essentially.
We're talking to Anahad O'Connor, health columnist at the Washington Post. He's been covering gut health for quite a long time now, looking at what foods promote gut health, the impact of a healthy ecosystem in our digestive system, and some of the products on the market, for better or worse. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's check out one of those varieties of products, Anahad, prebiotic sodas. You asked some healthcare experts. These are big in certain corners of social media, influencers selling these pretty heavy, the idea that these precursor products are going to be good for us. What did you find out when you talked to experts about things like prebiotic sodas available on the market?
Have become quite popular. They tend to have a type of prebiotic known as inulin, and that is a type of fiber that's been shown to promote beneficial bacteria. But these prebiotic sodas can have quite high levels of inulin, and it turns out that in this case, you can't have too much of a good thing. There are some studies suggesting that when people consume really high levels of inulin, particularly when it's isolated, when it's extracted and isolated and then mixed into these sodas, if you're consuming, you know, two or three of these a day, that can cause gastrointestinal distress. And some studies show that that can even cause inflammation in some people. Essentially, it's, you know, you're consuming it at a level that your body's not used to, and it can be too much for your body to handle at once. But the thing is, there are actually a lot of foods with these special prebiotics in them. You can get prebiotics just by eating a lot of plants. So prebiotic foods include things like asparagus, onions, garlic, leeks, cabbage, peas, tomatoes, chicory, chickpeas, whole grains like oats, barley, rye, wheat, and corn, even fruits, apples, berries, bananas, and then nuts like almonds, pistachios, cashews, and seeds. These natural plant foods all contain prebiotics. That's one of the fibers they have. So they have a variety of fibers, including these special prebiotic fibers that are really good at promoting the beneficial bacteria.
Talking about the gut microbiome with Anahad O'Connor from the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried some of the products on the market, probiotics, you name it? Did they seem to have an impact for you? What questions do you have about our guest coverage of this part, an important part of our health? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Anahad O'Connor, health columnist for The Washington Post. He's with us today to share his reporting on the evolving research into our gut microbiomes, our digestive health, and how that all fits into wider physical and mental health issues. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I have a question. Back when I was in school, I learned in my advanced microbiology course, the teacher was kind of against these dietary probiotic supplements and said that they don't really work just because of the you know, the density and so on and so forth. And, you know, by the time it gets to your gut, one thing that he did teach in the course was that your compositional diet, you know, the sugars, the fats, the proteins, the carbohydrates and stuff like that does actually cause like different, you know, different microflora to, you know, fill up your gut, I guess. And then that affects how much you get out of your food.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Anahad, first of all, you did talk to people about these probiotic supplements. What did you hear?
Yeah, so probiotic supplements, one reason they're very popular is because of antibiotics. You know, we use a lot of antibiotic medicines to help fight off infections. Antibiotics have been, you know, really life-saving and critical. They've even helped to increase the average lifespan of the average American because they've been so crucial in medicine. But what we know is that antibiotics, they kill off the bad bacteria, the infections we want to get rid of, but they can also kill off the beneficial bacteria in our guts and in our bodies. And so there's this idea that if you take an antibiotic, you should pair it with a probiotic supplement to help repopulate your gut with beneficial bacteria. And we know from some studies that there are some benefits in this case to taking probiotics. Probiotics can help to reduce, for example, the diarrhea that is sometimes a side effect of taking antibiotic medications. But there have been studies that have looked into this and found that when people take probiotic supplements, it actually can shift your gut microbiome into sort of a different composition. And they found that when people don't take probiotic supplements after a course of antibiotics, that their gut microbiome typically reverts back to normal after a few weeks. But if they take this probiotic, it kind of shifts the composition of your gut microbiome in a direction and actually makes it can make it less diverse. And we know in studies that when people have a very diverse gut microbiome, that tends to be associated with good health. And we think that's because, you know, as I said, the gut microbiome is an ecosystem. It's sort of like a garden. You want to have a lot of different species of bacteria because these bacteria can all work together and they do different things. They keep one another in check. Some bacteria produce byproducts or postbiotics that are the food for other bacteria. Certain bacteria might, you know, really like to metabolize a certain type of food, and then other bacteria want to metabolize other foods. And, you know, it's just an ecosystem where you don't want one species sort of running amok. And they found that when people take probiotics, particularly after a course of antibiotics, that it can decrease their gut microbiome diversity. And that's sort of pushing things in the wrong direction. And so, you know, there are gastroenterologists who study the gut microbiome who say that one thing they tend to do is recommend that people take what they call nature's probiotics. And those, again, are fermented foods. And, you know, those are, you know, the probiotics that we have been consuming for thousands of years. You look at cultures around the world, and almost every culture, you know, has some sort of fermented food that's a part of their traditional diet. You know, sauerkraut in Eastern Europe, and kimchi in you know, Asia. There's hundreds of fermented foods that are part of traditional diets around the world. And so, you know, the fermented foods, they contain these probiotics, but they also have the prebiotics, which are important, the fertilizer, and they have the postbiotics. So you're getting, you know, all these, this sort of rich soup or this rich food with this combination of good things for your gut. The other thing I think he mentioned was promoting microflora and the effect that I think he mentioned on your weight, I think he said. Mm-hmm. There was actually a really fascinating study recently that sort of demonstrated, when we think about weight loss, that all calories are not created equal. And one of the reasons for that is because of the gut microbiome. There was a study where they took people, they put them in metabolic chambers where they were able to measure their caloric expenditure, track their weight loss, track every calorie they consumed, and they gave them two different diets. On one diet was a sort of standard American processed food diet with things like American cheese and ground beef and potato chips and cookies and candy and sugary drinks and fruit juices, things that don't have very much fiber. And again, fiber is the thing that our gut microbes love, and the standard American diet tends to be very fiber deficient. And these are foods that are absorbed very rapidly in our intestines. We absorb them very quickly in our small intestines, and there's very little fiber that travels through the small intestine and gets to the large intestine at the end of our digestive tract where the gut microbiome is. And so when you're eating this ultra-processed, fiber-deficient diet, you're almost starving your gut microbes. And in this study, they had another diet that was a fiber-rich diet with, you know, foods like oats and barley and lots of plants and fruits and vegetables. And on that diet, they found that the people's gut microbiomes were thriving. And they found were absorbing fewer calories. So both of these diets had the same amount of calories, let's say 2,000 calories per diet. But on one diet, the ultra-processed food diet, people were absorbing significantly more of the calories into their bodies. While on the other diet, the fiber-rich diet, it was almost like they were feeding a lot of their calories to the gut microbes. And so people actually started to lose weight on the fiber-rich diet because it was, you know, essentially they were feeding a lot of their calories to the gut microbes. And the best part is that the gut microbes, in turn, were producing higher levels of beneficial compounds like short-chain fatty acids. And they even helped these people produce higher levels of GLP-1, which is a satiety hormone. And we all have heard, you know, these wonder stories about these drugs, Wegovy and Ozempic. Well, these drugs are designed to mimic GLP-1. And it turns out that when you feed your gut microbes fiber, they produce short chain fatty acids, and that helps to increase your body's natural production of GLP-1. And so that's one reason why fiber is so good for you, and why so many studies have shown that fiber actually helps with weight loss.
Talking to Anhad O'Connor from the Washington Post about our gut health, our microbiomes, and wider issues related to them. Back to your calls now. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Great topic, Rob. My question, I was going to ask about the foods with the good bacteria in it, but I have another question because you kind of answered that. I've heard that eating meat really can drop your good microbiome down, the good bacteria, and eating like a meal a day or something with meat can really drop that, and it takes a while to build it back up.
Perry, thanks for the call. Anahad, I know we've talked about the good stuff, like a variety of veggie and plant products, the bad stuff, very processed, you know, the donuts I love to eat. Where do we know where meat fits into the picture, meats fit into the picture when it comes to our microbiome?
Yeah, that's a good question. There hasn't been a ton of research on meat specifically. So most of what the research has shown is that typically people who are very healthy tend to have a diverse gut microbiome, as I said, with lots of different species. And, you know, a diverse gut microbiome tends to be associated with better health, you know, with lower rates of chronic diseases, better or less obesity, things like that. And one way to achieve a diverse gut microbiome is just to eat a wide variety of whole foods. So in this actual study that I talked about, where they showed that this healthy, fiber-rich diet, what they called a microbiome enhancer diet, because this diet was really feeding the gut microbes, they actually did include some meat in that microbiome enhancer diet. But the key was really what they were adding. It was all the fiber, you know, all these just a wide variety of fiber-rich foods, oats, vegetables, fruits, nuts and seeds. And so they found, you know, what we're seeing from studies is that I haven't really seen any studies that show that meat in particular is going to, you know, have a pretty detrimental effect on your gut microbiome. But if you're eating, sort of a whole foods diet that includes some meat, seafood, poultry, but you have a lot of fiber-rich foods, then that tends to be associated with, you know, promoting a diverse gut microbiome. And there have been studies looking at sort of modern hunter-gatherer populations around the world where they eat, you know, these populations like the modern hunter-gatherers in Tanzania and in South America. They sort of eat the way our ancestors have eaten, you know, for thousands of years. And they typically have diets that have much higher levels of fiber than the standard American diet. We're talking like 10 times, like 10 times the amount of fiber that we eat on a daily basis. But they also do include some meat in their diets. They go hunting. They try to, it varies day by day, but they try to have some meat in their diet to get their protein. But, you know, fiber is really the basis of their diets. And that's what we know is going to really promote what appears to be an optimal gut microbiome. That's the key, fiber, fermented foods.
Perry, thanks for that call. And Anahad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Anahad O'Connor, health columnist for The Washington Post, who writes about food and nutrition. He's with us today to talk about some of the latest research and reporting on our gut microbiomes and how to improve our digestive health. I guess my gut doesn't know which side I'm on because I eat a lot of the good stuff we were talking about, but I love donuts and other pastries. So fight it out down there, I guess, guys.